Well, I'm Lance, an alcoholic.
Hi, Lance. We love you, Lance. Lots and lots and lots.
How much?
Oh. Lunches.
Thank you. I believe if you guys were my solution, that might have just did it. So I'm nervous. I've never talked to this many empty chairs before. And we'll kind of see where this goes and how it ends up. I love being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being an alcoholic today. I get to meet some of the coolest people. I get to do some of the coolest things through all this suffering. And I wouldn't change it for anything today. There's times in my life where I'm walking with these principles and my life can't get any better. There is nothing, no area of my life that needs to improve. And that's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love the fact that I get to watch people change. I get to watch fathers become fathers. I mean, legitimately become a father to their kids. And I'm honored to be able to do that kind of stuff. And a guy like me gets to do things like that through these principles. It's absolutely amazing. And I wouldn't give it up for anything. I did not start out that way. I come from a separated family. That is not why I'm an alcoholic. I have my dad, my biological dad, and my stepdad drank every day. My biological dad was a pretty violent man. That is not why I'm an alcoholic. It has nothing to do with it, absolutely nothing. But I didn't know that for a long time, and that's what I carried around with me for a long time. And I jump around a lot in my story, so I'm sorry if it's hard to follow along, but we'll do the best we can. So as a kid, you know, I didn't feel like I fit in. I was just listening to a speaker one day, and he nailed me on the head. He said, like, when he showed up at kindergarten, it was like all these other kids showed up a week or two before him and learned how to socialize and to do this school thing. And he felt way on the outside. And he said that if someone would give him a shot of Jack, he would have fit right in with those kids. And I would have. I would have fit right in with them. That's my experience with alcohol. It made me the person I always wanted to be. It appeared, anyway. That is not when I started drinking. Yeah, it comes a little bit later. So through going to school, I missed a lot of school. I missed so much school that they held me back a year because of it. I missed so much school that they put me in special classes, and I got very embarrassed about that. I hated having to walk into that class. And instead of doing like what I think, I don't know, your normal person would do and get busy and do things, backed up more, and I stopped going to school even less. In my middle school years, the principal would actually come to my house and pick me up, and I was very embarrassed about that. And on one of these trips from my house to the school, he looked at me and said, Lance, you miss more school than you come. And this is who I am. I make my parents think I'm going to go get on the bus, and I just go somewhere else. And it seems like the way to live. I haven't touched alcohol yet. I haven't touched any drugs. But this is just what I do. I just don't feel comfortable anywhere. I mean, I don't feel comfortable anywhere. And I can't hardly stand it. And I don't know why. I have no idea what's wrong with me. And again, when I start thinking about it, which I normally don't, I just don't think about it. I just do. But when I do, I know it's my parents' fault for not raising me right. And I'm pretty sure of that. And I even play the sympathy card to people who start coming down on me to get responsible and stuff. Well, you know, if I would have had better parents, I wouldn't be this way. And that did not produce any kind of results in my life at all. My first real drunk was my older sister's graduation. You know, I'd sampled beer. I'd stole beer from my dad from time to time before that. But my first real drunk, when the magic happened, I stole a fifth of strawberry schnapps from my parents while they were having a party for my sister, and I made amends for this too, and I just took off. Not that I didn't do anything at that party. I wasn't there. I wasn't there to help celebrate my sister's achievement, right? Because it was always about me. And I take off of this bottle, and I get a little bit of that bottle down inside me, and something changed. Bill W. wrote a letter to Carl Jung, thanking him for the contribution to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know how much history you guys know, and I'm not going to get too far into it, but Carl Jung helped the guy that helped Ebby that helped Bill. Fair enough? And so Carl Jung wrote him a letter thanking him for that. Carl Jung responded with a letter, and you can find this letter in Language of the Heart if you're interested. But in this letter, he words it a lot better than what I'm about to. But he said he believed that a person like me, he wasn't talking about me, but people like me, drink the way I drink because it gives me a false sense of the presence of my Creator. Man, I read that and it just clicked. And that's exactly what happened. It was a spiritual experience. I think Bree referred to it in her talk. It was a spiritual experience. I understood differently, I felt differently, and I acted differently. And I thought I'd just found a solution to all my problems. I'd watched my dad do this, and it seemed to work for him. I mean, there were some people that didn't like him too much, but he seemed to get by in life, all right, and he seemed to be having a good time. So that became my achievement in life. Is to drink as much as I possibly could and as often as I could. It started out just weekends, and then somewhere through my high school times, it started getting more into the week and things like that. And then at about 16, at that time, I knew I was never going to touch drugs. People that did drugs were bad people, and I knew it. But alcohol was okay because, you know, it's just okay. And, you know, I had this thought, these beliefs. Could you just pass me down that water, please? Thank you. I had these thoughts that alcohol was okay to drink before I even started drinking. And what that looked like is I had an aunt and uncle that I spent a lot of time with as a kid. And my aunt, thank you, told me that her and my uncle only drank a glass of wine at Christmas time. And I was baffled by that. I didn't understand. Why wouldn't you do this more often, was my belief. And I haven't even touched alcohol yet. And I don't know if that's a conditioning thing or not, or if that's just my makeup. That's just who I am. But I get to be about 16, and I realize that weed is a lot easier to come by than alcohol. And I start getting high. And I'm going to talk about this a little bit, but I am not a drug addict. I'm not, man. And there are drug addicts. I'm not debating that one for a moment. I'm not. Because drugs reacted a lot different in me than alcohol. I could get high, and I've never been too high, ever. Not one day in my life. I might have been high too long. According to responsibilities, but I never went over that threshold with drugs. I always knew when to stop and when to just ride it out. And that's not my experience with alcohol. Alcohol is just the opposite. Every time I drank, I went over that threshold. You know what I mean? Where you take that drink and all of a sudden you're able to breathe. A little bit like right now. And you just, and the magical thing happens. But when that, with weed and cocaine, and I got led into a little bit of the LSD and mushrooms and stuff, that wasn't really my thing, but if you had it, why not? And but I could get to that point and just be happy. But that ain't my experience with alcohol. And I didn't understand why. You know, I didn't get it. And I started to do things. Well, anyway, they asked me to leave school because of just who I was. And I considered that a get-out-of-jail-free card. That did not look like a bad thing to me. And this is just where I'm at. And I go out and I try to work for a living, and I'm just as bad at that as I am my education. And I'm a bum. I am just literally a bum. There's nothing attractive, nothing cool, nothing fun about my drinking in any form. Man, if it was, I'd still be doing it because I loved what happened inside me. So I get kicked out of high school, and I just start bumming around, really. I start mooching off whoever let me mooch off them. I have aunts that took pity on me quite a bit, a couple of them. So I had a couple places I could go sleep from time to time. And from time to time, my parents would let me back in the house, and I would screw it up every time, man. Every time they let me in there, I would mess it up. I got to the point where I couldn't see outside of myself. I couldn't see what I was doing to anybody else. And my stepdad was a hardworking man. This man, he taught me. Whew, that snuck up. There's a guy I used to listen to speak. I am somewhat of an emotional slob, so just write it out. My dad taught me principles that I live by today. And if there could have been a human being that could have saved me, it would have been my stepdad. And I didn't like him much. You know? And I'll get a little more about that into the amends process. But I got to the point where he would lock me out of the house because he couldn't have me in his house. And I was on one of those benders that I would do where I'd be gone for 2 or 3 days, and I'd come home and all the doors were locked. So I kicked in his door, and that seemed like a rational thing to me to do. It didn't seem like I was harming someone, right? And he'd come home and seen the door in the condition it was, but by the time he got home, I'd cleaned up and I was back out again. And so I come back again, and I get back there, and he stops me, and he says, "Lance, I'm going to do one more thing for you. I'm going to give you a ride wherever you want to go, but then you are not allowed back in this house." And at this time, I think I'm about 17, 18 years old. And I know I got an aunt. This aunt loves me. She still loves me, and I still love her very, very much. But she was the one, you know, like, yeah, you know, your dad, Lance, was a real, I'll hold back on what I was going to say, but she just hated my dad. And she would always give me this sympathy because of it, because I had that dad. And I'd soak it up. I just soak it up. So I knew she would let me back in her house. So I said, "Give me a ride to my Aunt Mex." And if she ever listens to this tape, know that I do love you very much. And we're on our way. I grew up down around Adelissa, West Liberty, Iowa City, Muscatine area. I kind of floated around that area. And my aunt lived in Muscatine, and I was headed back to Muscatine, and me and my dad get to about Muscatine, and we're about a block outside of town, about a quarter mile. And there's this guy walking on the road, and you can tell this guy's got no home. Man, he probably hasn't had a shower in quite a while. My dad wasn't much of a crier. And he just started bawling. because he knew that was my destiny. That's who I was going to be, and that's who I could become. You know, I was, you know, I wish I had some cool stories about how I flew cocaine from Mexico to Florida, to how the plane almost crashed and I survived and all that stuff, but that's not my story. My story is I was a bum and I used people. You know, I didn't have enough ambition to be a successful drug dealer even. Oh, Lordy. So somewhere between 16 to 19, they start sending me professionals. They start putting me in jail. They start doing the things that we do. And I would see these professional people, these people that have their life together, and these people that probably legitimately wanted to help me. They probably legitimately would like to have seen me do better. I believe that. I don't believe they were doing it just for a paycheck, because some of them don't get paid all that much money. And they would say things to me like, Lance, you're drinking alcohol to escape reality. Then I'd be like, fair enough. Okay, now what? What do I do? How do I stop trying to escape reality? And they really had nothing. They really had nothing. But I believed what they were saying. So what I heard them saying is that I'm a bum. I'm just no good. I am just no good. Is it Hank Williams Jr., Family Tradition? Am I thinking of the right song? That's what I believe, man. My dad does this. My uncles does this. My older brother does this. That's why I do it. And, again, no results, man. It just kept getting worse and worse and worse. Because I don't have any idea what's going on with me. I think I just have lack of morals. And I never really considered myself a bad guy. And, man, I don't like sharing this stuff with you people. I don't. I want you to have an image of me as a good man. Without these principles, I'm not. So at 19, I meet this girl. And I had hair back then, and I was a little bit better looking. And it never seemed to be too big of a problem for me to meet girls. And I meet this girl, and we start doing what we do, and we have a little girl. And I'm 19, and I want to grow up. I do, man. I want to be a father to this child. And I use the excuse that, well, my real dad wasn't ever there, so I want to make it different. I've heard people from the podium talk about how you could have put me on a lie detector test and I would have passed. And I would have told you that I'm ready to stop this way of life. I'm going to go get a job, and I'm going to hold that job, and I'm going to support this little girl. And I couldn't. I'd fail. I got a job at a meat packing plant. That's about what my education would, that's about as far as it would reach. And I would work, and I would get paid on Friday. And I'm not of age yet to drink in the bars, but I seem to manage somehow. And then, and somewhere in there, cocaine came into this mix too a little bit. And I would go get an 8-ball and some booze, and I would be gone. They wouldn't see me for 2 or 3 days. And by the time I came back, I'm flat broke. I'm coming down off this coke, and you get me in that situation, I become a very violent person. And I started becoming abusive to my daughter's mother. And I knew at that line, that point, I crossed over from just being a wild guy to being the bad guy. I've now just condemned myself to hell, and there's nothing I can do about it. And I really started falling off the edge. I started going to jail quite a bit, and it wasn't for nothing, you know, crazy or anything. It was just public intoxes, avoiding arrest, resisting arrest, just all that stuff. And they got me in Muscatine County for something. And for one reason or another, they transported me to a different county. I don't even remember which one. But I got down to this other county, and they put me in a cell by myself. And I start contemplating. You know, whenever I got in those situations, I would start looking at my life and start questioning what's going on here. This is not who I intended on being. And I happened to have a Bible in this cell. And I picked up this Bible and I started reading it. And I can't understand a damn thing it's saying. I have no idea what they're trying to tell me. Not one. So I take this Bible and I throw it across the room. And I say, I think the first prayer my whole life, and it wasn't a prayer, it was a demand kind of thing. I said, if you put that Bible on this table, by the time I wake up in the morning, I'll believe in you. And I'm in a lockdown cell. No one else can come in or out. I don't know what I expected, but that was the conditions I put on it. And obviously, the Bible is exactly where I threw it. And I did it again. I was like, all right. I just got to get a little bit tougher. Because in my mind, this is about being tough, right? It has nothing to do with being principled or unprincipled. It's about whether I'm tough enough to live like this. That night, they transport me back to Muscatine, Iowa. And I get to that cell, and I look down right at now I'm in a cell with other inmates. And I look down, and there's this cartoon pamphlet of what someone's belief in God is. I'm thinking, right, this is for my speed. And I start reading this thing, and I get absolutely terrified. Because something happened. And what had happened is I started to get a sense that there is really some kind of a power out there. And I knew I was screwed. Because I knew this power had seen all the things I had done to women, all the things I had done to my parents, to my grandparents. I just knew the way I was living, I was condemned. And that's what I believed. And I took this pamphlet and I tossed it, and it hit the table right beside me, and it fell down on the floor, and I didn't think anything of it. The next morning, I opened my eyes. I mean, right when I opened my eyes, another inmate is bending down, picking that up, and setting it on the table. And I got terrified. I got absolutely terrified because I knew there was a God and that I didn't measure up. I got out of that situation. I don't believe I'd been introduced to you guys yet, but I was getting real close. And I got out, and I went to what I knew. I went to what I knew brought me relief, and that's what it was all about, is getting Lance relief, because if I don't get relief at this point in my life, I'm going to shoot myself in the head, because I can't stand myself for very long. And I go out and start to do what I do, and it's all kind of blurry anymore, what happened in what order, but somehow ended up in treatment. While I was in this treatment center, I listened to what they had to say, and what they did is made me aware that my drinking is a problem, not a solution. Right? That's what they did for me. It really was. And that was about it. But that was enough. That's all they're supposed to do. Right? Even in our book, in the back of the book, some of the psychiatrists that worked with us in the very beginning, they come to the realization that their job is to make us realize just how screwed up we are, and then turn us over to us, because we have the solution. But it's still crucial. You know, I was one of those guys, man, let's get rid of those treatment centers. We can handle this. We got this. We are the solution. Well, we're not, but we know what the solution is. And here we go, jumping around, sorry. But me and a couple guys, some good friends of mine, we go to Eldora, the youth detention center, and we take a meeting into that program. We've been doing that for about 5 years now, I think, maybe a little longer. But when we first started, they had an alcohol and drug program in there. And when those kids would come to us, you could see that they were having or have had a first step experience. They seen that their alcohol and drugs, and I just say that just for that situation, because they are, I don't mean to step on singleness of purpose. I'm a strong believer in that. They would come to us, though, and realize they got a problem. Because of state funding and other issues, they don't have an alcohol and drug program in there anymore. So these kids come to us, and, man, we're starting from scratch. I mean, we could take them. There was a couple kids. We got up to the fourth step, and these kids did a fourth step, and they couldn't do it with us. The facility wouldn't allow it. So they had to do a fourth step with a minister on site, which is just fine. And today we're not getting to that point. But it's still quite an experience. I love to do it. I'll do it as long as they allow me. So there's my pitch on professionals. So I forget where I was at with my story. I get out of these treatment centers, and I'd been introduced to you guys, and I was really happy for you. I was really glad that you found something. But you just touched each other way too much, and you were just a little too friendly. It was, you just set me back a little bit. I just wasn't ready for all that. And I'm 18, 19 years old now, and I haven't been into some of the trouble some of you guys have. You know, I haven't been divorced. I haven't done this. I haven't done that. I'm just not quite as bad as you. So I keep doing what I'm doing, but my drinking, something's happened. Like I said, they made me aware my drinking is a problem, not a solution. And I try to consume more, but I can no longer get to the place alcohol used to take me. And I believe today that if alcohol would take me back to that place, I would probably use it again. I don't question that. You get me without this stuff. Even with all the bad experiences I've had with alcohol, you leave me without these principles long enough, I'm going to hurt long enough, alcohol will look like a solution to me again. And if that ever happens, I will lose that decision. I guess I never, and at this time, I tell you, I've been sober 27 years, and it doesn't make a difference. It has no weight when it comes to that aspect. I am just as much as powerless over alcohol today as I was the day I walked into rooms. And I tell you the truth, I think I got to do quite a bit more work today than I did when I first walked into the rooms. And there's probably multiple reasons, but one of the main reasons I think it is when I first got here to you guys this time around, when I'm seeking, I'm as close to surrender as I've ever been in my whole life. Right? That first year of sobriety, I was way more surrendered than I am today. Way more. I mean, today I actually think, well, I've been sober a while now. I've had a job. I got a wife. I got kids. I got a home. I can start making decisions now. And it gets kind of messy. I still burn my life to the ground from time to time. But I get out, and I continue to drink. One night I go out with, don't ever move in to somebody you met in treatment. Not a good idea. So me and these two guys, we met in treatment, and we got hooked up, and we moved in together, and we thought, this will work out good. Within 2 weeks, we're all drinking and drugging again. And I'm going through an experience of, and this is just how my brain works. I have never caught a drug charge one day in my life. Every time I got arrested, and not that that qualifies me as an alcoholic, it doesn't. This is just how my brain works. Every time I got arrested, I was drinking. Never through drugs. Drugs, man, I could go off and be happy. You put alcohol in me, I got to go somewhere. I got to run. I don't know what it is I think I got to do, but I'm not sitting still. And I had this thought, if I just stay away from the drugs and drink, I'll be okay. I don't know where that thought come from, but it worked. It got that first drink down in my system. 2 weeks after that drink, you know, I'm right back to where I was. And I'm out with these two guys that I live with, and some of their friends. I keep hitting that thing. And we're out doing what I do. And we get out there drinking and doing some other things, and they got a joint. They're passing around a joint. And in my head, they pass me up. And they're trying to bogart that thing. I slam the brakes on the car. I'm driving. I slam the brakes off, whip it down into the ditch, yank the guy out of the car, and we start fighting. His buddy jumps in. I start fighting him, too. This is who I am. And I'm not tough. Please don't think that I think I'm tough, because I know that I'm not. You talk to anybody from my past, tough is not the word that comes out when they go to describe me. Probably some other choice words, but... And that, all of a sudden, the joint gets passing around again, and we're okay. So we start driving again. We get down into Iowa City, and they do something else that sets me off. And we start fighting again. And this time I kick them out of my car and make them start walking. We're not too far from the house, so it's not too big a deal. And I drive by, and they throw a rock through my window. I'm mad again, so I whip the car back around. And one of their cars is parked at their house, so they busted out my window, so I'm going to ram my car into their car to make it right. So I do. And I jump out of the car, and I grab one of the guys. I start beating him up, and a guy hits me across the back with a 2x4. I go down, and I get the worst ass beating I've ever had in my whole life. I think they had me real close. And... some friends pick me up, and they take me and clean me up. And I think that I need to make this right. I get very confused at times. I see things that are not true. I see, if I'm kind of Jordan, at the right time, I see that as a weakness. I see that as... Jordan will now take advantage of me, and other people will see that and treat me like I'm weak. I think if I'm aggressive and mean to Jordan and inconsiderate, then I'm being strong. And I don't know why I'm like that, but that's who, excuse me, that's who shows up without these principles. So I think I need to go find my brother, make this whole situation right. And I'm driving down Highway 6 in Iowa City, and I see something laying in the middle of the road, and I don't think much of it. I thought someone dropped something out of the back of the truck. And I adjust my car to straddle this thing. And I get about from me to this young lady right here, and I see a face. And by the time I realize it's a young girl laying in the middle of the road, I run over this girl and I killed her. And I left that girl laying in the middle of the road. And I went and hid at a friend's house. And he had told me what had happened. And he asked me to leave because he had a lot of drugs and stuff at the house, and he didn't want no trouble. So I left his house and I went to another friend's house. This friend seen how bad I was beat up, and he took me to the hospital. This is just who I am. And I get to the hospital, and I start to sober up, and this stuff starts to wear off, and I start thinking about what had just happened. And I ask him to bring a couple policemen in. I think at this time they think I'm going to tell them who beat me up. But I don't. I talk to them about what had happened the night before, and they let me go. And I still don't understand that today, but they let me go. And I had to call my stepdad to come pick me up. And for probably the last 6 years of my life, all I did was bring bad news after bad news. It man, it's just getting me today. Something about you guys, I guess. Yep. And so here I go. I got to give him some more bad news. News that just crushes people. And I think I'm 20 years old at this time. And I got to tell him, I said, Dad, I think I killed somebody last night. I mean, what do you say? They left me out on the streets for about a year. In that year's time, I became a daily drunk. And I found comfort in that. I found a lot of comfort. I thought, this is it. This is just who I am. This is what I'll do. I'll drink every day. It works. But there was something, you know, there's just a little voice back here that went, man, I don't think this is a good idea. And I went a year that way. I kind of got away from the weed and the cocaine and just stuck with my alcohol. January 24th, 1991, they incarcerate me. And I'm absolutely terrified. I'm at eighth grade, I got to be 6 foot and 145 pounds, and I kind of stayed there until I got incarcerated. So pretty tall, skinny dude. And I get in there, and they put me in Oakdale, there in Iowa City. Oakdale, right? It's called Oakdale. And I'm in there, man, and I'd been introduced to you guys enough that I could recognize our literature, right? And they didn't have a big book that I seen, but I noticed the 12 by 12. And at that time down in Iowa City, a lot of people were talking about the 12 by 12. They didn't talk about the big book that much. And I grabbed that book and I started reading it because I'm desperate. I'm hurt. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. And I start reading this book. And in step 11, we borrowed a prayer from St. Francis. If you ever hear anybody say that that's 11-step prayer, please correct them, because it is not. It is not. That's the prayer of St. Francis. That man sacrificed a lot to come up with that prayer. Let's not steal it. And I read that prayer, and as soon as I got done reading that prayer, I knew differently. Something happened to me. And it's as free as I've ever been in my whole life. And I'm in this, I think, what are they, maybe 3x5 cell, and I am absolutely free. I have no fear in me whatsoever, not 1 ounce. And I do the first 3 steps at that moment, and I don't even know what they are. Once I got here and you guys informed me, and then I understood what had happened. And I turned my life over. And I said, and what the prayer looked like is, you take it, I don't know what to do with this thing. And that prayer worked. And I've been, from that day to this very moment, I've been trying to get back to that state of surrender through my whole sobriety. And I have not achieved it. I haven't. I have never been that surrendered of a man. So I went through their program. Between there and a couple other facilities, I was incarcerated just about the first year of my sobriety, not quite. And I got out, and I started to look for girls. And I heard there were some in AA. So there I went. And that's not the complete truth. I was still seeking, man. I was seeking a solution. I was ready for things to be different. But I'm 21 now, and I'm a 21-year-old guy. That's fair enough. And I started to get pretty sideways with that stuff. I start going to meetings, you know, looking for Mrs. Wright. And I start going there for that reason. I am no longer going to Alcoholics Anonymous to seek a relationship with the God of my understanding. I'm going there to meet girls and to impress you guys by meeting the girls. Remember, I still had hair at this time. And I start to get pretty sick. And thank God that I had enough surrender left in me that I sought out a sponsor. And I got this sponsor, and I chose this sponsor because when he got up to the podium and talked, I would watch, and I still do today, I watch people at AA meetings. I watch how they respond and who they're responding to. And this guy, his name was Dale. It was Dale B. from the Downtown Group in Waterloo, Iowa. And he'd get up to the podium, man, and people would listen. When that guy talked, boom, they were on him. So I was like, this guy knows something. And then I noticed also that when he wasn't around, they talked a lot of crap behind his back. It was kind of a weird deal. And so I started working with Dale, and Dale took me as far in this program as he possibly could have. You know, I'd done a fifth step while I was incarcerated. I got put into this treatment program that became mandatory that you do a fifth step before you could get out. So I did, and it was as honest as a fifth step as I could do. And what it was a list of all the bad things I'd ever done in my life. That was it. That was the extent of it. And there was some freedom that came from that. Guaranteed. There definitely was. That is not what's outlined in our book, but that's what I had. That's the best thing I had to work with, so that's what I worked with, and I was willing. I think willingness is way more important than what's described in the book, right? I mean, willingness is described in the book, but I don't really need to know what's in here as long as I'm willing. I really don't. Like I told you, I did my first three steps not having a clue what the first three steps were. That honest desire is a key thing. And it don't even have to be, you know, a desire. It can be just a teeny bit. And it will grow. So like Dale, he told me, I get out and I start doing the start work with Dale. And he convinces me to get a home group. He convinces me that I am to see him from time to time since he was my sponsor. And he says, I want you to do a four-step. I said, okay. Well, what I said was, well, I just did one while I was incarcerated. He said, well, I'll do another one. I said, okay, because I'm still willing. And I don't even remember what we did. I tell you the truth, we didn't read it out of the book. And I'm pretty sure that. It probably had more to do with the 12x12 at that time. And I wrote down some stuff about myself, some fears around sex, fears around work, not measuring up, not being a good dad, things like that. And I went and shared it with this rabbi, and I didn't have much of an experience, but I did it because that's what I was directed to do. Dale passed away when I had about 3 years of sobriety, and I figured, I've been doing this for 3 years. I think I got it. I don't think I need a sponsor. And I went a while without a sponsor, and things started to, you know, fall apart again. And I asked this guy that had quite a bit of time, and I liked what he had to say when he's up at the podium, things like that. He wasn't anything like me. We were way different. I wore holy jeans and T-shirt and a hat, and he dressed like this a lot. But he seemed to have good things to say, so I asked him to be my sponsor. And all we did was we talked on the phone when my life was on fire. And that man went back out drinking when he had 25 years sobriety. And he died. And again, I'm thinking, I got this. I'm good. I got this guy that I call my sponsor. He was funny. He was a funny dude, man. He told good jokes. And I'm living my life as if I'm in control of it again. And I'm not doing very well. I tell you, I don't know what possessed me to do this. I'm living with my wife, Haley, at this time. And I put a recorder up to record me just while I'm reacting around the house. Ooh, man, I was a whiner. It was embarrassing. It was just, I couldn't stand watching myself. And this is who I am, in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe I may have been to GSR in my home group. I have a home group. I go to at least 3 to 5 meetings every week. I think I might have been involved in district. And when I wake up in the morning, I can't stand it. I cannot stand the idea of having to go back to work again. This is crap. And on my way home from work, I start thinking, I'm anywhere from 3 to 5 years sober. I'm start thinking, if my car hits this pillar and I get taken out, I'd probably be okay with that. Because I can't stand just living life. I just can't stand it. And I'm thinking, I did not sober up to feel like this, to live like this. And it's still all about me. It's still all about me. I'm not really sponsoring anybody at the time. I've had people ask me, anybody their sponsor, and it's nothing but an ego thing. I mean, when I actually have to do something with them, it's kind of pisses me off. But I like to tell you, yeah, I'm sponsoring people. I'm somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there's a statement. This just jumped in my head. Back to when I was coming around AA for different reasons. I heard a guy, he said, yeah, coming to Alcoholics Anonymous looking for a relationship, it's like going to the dented can section in the supermarket looking for fresh fruit. It's just not going to happen. My wife is in the program, and we have a very beautiful relationship. And I know a lot of the people that I run with today, they are in a relationship in Alcoholics Anonymous. They met in AA. They did not come to AA looking for that. I didn't come to AA looking for friends. I didn't come to AA looking for anything. But it has all showed up, every bit of it, every bit of it. So I'm going down to my home group, which is a big book study, and there's this guy sitting in a room that I've never seen before. I have no idea what time it is. Where are we at? And it gets around to this guy sharing, and this guy says, alcohol's never been my problem. He says, well, my problem is I'm selfish and self-centered. And this guy rung my bell. It just clicked. I'm like, this guy's got something. So I looked forward to every Wednesday coming back and seeing this guy and listening to him. And about, I don't know, 2 or 3 times of listening to him, I walked up to him and I said, I want what you got. And he said, okay, we're going to meet together once a week, and we're going to go through the process of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, okay. And we decided on Thursdays. He was from Eldridge, Iowa, and he was up at Waterloo doing some work for John Deere. This man was very intelligent. Companies would hire him to come up and fix things in their organization, or the way they're organized kind of thing. And that Thursday comes around, and I do what I always do, man. I'm always pumped, like, yeah, all right, we're going to do some work. Then it comes time to do the work, I'm thinking of reasons why to get out of it. And I get to driving to this guy's place, and I start having thoughts. I start thinking, what if this guy's kind of a weirdo? Maybe because he invited me to his hotel room, right? And this is me, man. I'm sick. I am sick. Because I can't see love, right? It's outside of my scope. And what got me walking through that door, other than desperation, was I thought, I think I could take him if things were. That's who shows up, man. That is who shows up. God. But I sit down with this guy, and we start talking about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. At this time, he doesn't take me page by page, word by word. He takes me through the process, and he did a phenomenal job, and I'm truly grateful that man saved my life. That man directed me to what saved my life. That'd be a more accurate statement. And we're going to say I'm 5 years sober. And he goes, Lance, what's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said that you can be sober. I'm proud. I'm like, yeah, I nailed it. He goes, no, that's a consequence. He talked in a very educated way. He meant that that's just what happens when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you get sober. And my pride kicks in. Well, he says, so you got another one? I said, yeah, you can be sober and happy. And he just starts smiling. And he says, that's a consequence. He said, what's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous? And he would do this to me all the time. He says, I want you to think about it. We'll talk about it next week when you come back. And he says, I'll give you a hint. We read it before every meeting, most every meeting. I said, all right, So I go, I leave, and I'm not embarrassed. I'm a little ashamed of myself. I've been here 5 years, and apparently I don't know what the hell I'm supposed to be doing here. So I go to my home group, and I start asking members of my home group. I say, hey, what's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous? And they said that you could be sober, and I say, no, it's not. And they'd get pissed. I stirred up my home group quite a bit, and I don't know. I still don't know today if that was a good thing or a bad thing. So I get back to Peter, and he says, so Lance, what's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous? And the thing that always precedes a relationship with my Creator that ends in happiness and everything I've ever wanted in life happened. I reached that state of surrender again. And it was humbling and it was embarrassing. And he says, what's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, I don't know. And he smiled. And you know, for all of us that work with someone else, when they say, I don't know, you know there's a door open. And that something great's about to happen. And he goes, Lance, the message of Alcoholics Anonymous is that God couldn't, what if he were sought? That's all we got to offer. And that's what I've been living with ever since. And that's what I've been trying to teach ever since. That's what I try to be an example of ever since. I used to think that this was about me showing you what I can do through God. And I'm always backwards. Man, I'm always backwards. I don't know how long it's going to take me to learn. If I think something, just do the opposite and things will be okay. But this ain't what it's about. It's about what God can do through me for you. And when I walk that way, life cannot be any better. It really can't. We out of time? Yes. Thanks for asking me. I love being an agent for God. And life just couldn't get any better. Thanks. Thank you.